Discover the best in local business news with a subscription to the IBJ and Inside Indiana Business. For a limited time, try us out for just $1 a week for 8 weeks. Claim this limited time offer now at ibj.com/trial offer.
This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of Monday, March 16th, 2026, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Jamie Marisotis, president and CEO of Indianapolis-based Lumina Foundation, is one of the nation's top experts on providing access to higher education and the ways higher education can prepare the future workforce. Several years ago, he realized how the rapidly accelerating development of artificial intelligence could profoundly impact those two vital currents of American life. In 2020, he published a book titled Human Work in the Age of Smart Machines, warning that the roles of workers will radically shift, and spotlighting the need to redesign education, training, and the workplace as a whole. Today, he admits he underestimated the speed of change due to artificial intelligence. In fact, he says AI will be more disruptive, faster than any other wave of technology in history. Last month, he delivered an address to the Economic Club of Indiana about what the rise of AI means for jobs, education, and the economy in Indiana and the rest of the country. He's our guest on the podcast this week so we can dig deeper into his conclusions. Number one, AI is here to stay. In just a few years, AI will be good enough to do some jobs currently entrusted to C-suite executives. We humans need to be thinking about how we can complement AI and excel at work best handled with human traits and skills. In the meantime, higher education must undergo radical transformation as AI accelerates. At the same time, Marisotis defends liberal arts degrees that have become political punching bags in the last decade. Here's our conversation. It's my pleasure to welcome to the podcast Jamie Marisotis, president and CEO of Lumina Foundation. Jamie, thanks for making time to come to the studio today.
Delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Sure. Let's jump into AI with a quick preamble about how I personally have experienced its latest major iteration and the way that it impacts human work. Hopefully lay people will find something that resonates with them there. About 2 years ago, my three nephews, who were either in college at the time or had just finished, asked me if I had ever heard of ChatGPT. I think I had, but I had no idea really what it was. So they said it was an artificial intelligence tool that essentially could do your schoolwork for you. That's how they were experiencing it. And specifically could respond to a series of prompts and custom make a paper or an essay of any length on any topic. And my response was, oh, that sounds kind of problematic for people in academics. 2 years later, there is an urgent global conversation about how AI is impacting professional work, automating many tasks humans traditionally have been employed to do, leading to mass layoffs or slowdowns in hiring. There is some considerable fear that the speed with which corporate America is adopting AI could lead to a major recession. 6 years ago, you wrote a book titled Human Work in the Age of Smart Machines. So you were way ahead of this.
The topic of human work was not something that I had spent a lot of time thinking about, honestly. So my background is in education. I run a private foundation focused on post-high school learning. That's really my thing. And I had written a book in 2015 called America Needs Talent. And in America Needs Talent, I was trying to answer the question, how do we actually build a deeper bench when it comes to talent in the United States through a combination of learning, immigration, urban policy, a variety of things? In other words, this idea that talent is not just what people know and apply, but it's about people working in teams and in communities and things like that. And so I wrote this book and it got a lot of good attention. And then the publisher was like, so what's your second book? And I realized
that's a good thing to hear. Though,
exactly. Right. Exactly. Can we make some more money? Yeah. And so what I realized I was interested in was a topic I didn't know a lot about, which was at that point, this is 2017, 2018. What are the humans going to do in an increasingly technology mediated world? And recognizing as I got into the book that, in fact, artificial intelligence was the future. I realized we had to better answer the question, what will the humans do as machines perform more and more human tasks? And so that's what got me into the book, this idea that human work is something that we actually need to prepare people for, right? My background is at Lumina Foundation in helping to get more people into better educational opportunities. That's essentially our focus. And so I got very interested in how the technology was being developed. At that point, there was no such thing as ChatGPT, though the AI experts were talking about what we now call large language models. And I recognized that, in fact, this was going to accelerate. I was wrong about some things in the book, by the way. I did not think it would happen this fast or at the level that I think people are now, as you pointed out, expressing so much anxiety about it. But I think the fundamentals are still the same, which is that machines are getting better and better at performing human-like tasks. And we as humans need to develop our human skills and capabilities so that we can both work in a complementary sense with the machines, but also do things that are quite different than what machines do.
To what extent has AI already embedded itself into the workplace?
It is very much embedded. In fact, 80% of businesses in the United States use AI at some level already. And so it's an astonishing statistic. But the reality is that if you look at AI adoption by consumers, you know, the adoption by consumers for personal computers, you know, 50% of Americans were using personal computers within 10 years. We've got way more than that using AI at the consumer level in 2 years, within 2 years of the launch of ChatGPT, which was the fall of 2022. So we're now in this position where AI is not coming, it's here. It's a part of our daily lives, even if we're not aware of it. And that's one of the things that I think is different than going out and buying your first PC. It's embedded in a lot of the things that you do. So you're using AI if you're using Google, for example, because Google, you know, your search tools are now overwhelmingly driven by AI. You're using AI in lots of different contexts, banking and other ways that is just, you know, increasingly more common and ubiquitous. You know, I think AI is here. And I think what we now need to understand is how will we better prepare ourselves as people for this world of artificial intelligence? Or as someone said to me when I was writing the book came out in 2020, almost intelligent machines. that was their description of AI, almost intelligent. And how will we actually make sure that humanity will be better off as a result?
Okay. I would assume that it depends in part on the sector of the economy. Has it had a bigger effect on financial services than it has on agriculture, for example?
For sure. And there's varying levels of adoption depending on the industry. So yes, you are seeing it being applied more in things like financial services, you know, issues that people are talking about, news, the way that people are using it to develop, you know, every PR firm in America is worried about AI, you know, those kinds of things. But accounting is another example of, you know, a very, very deep adoption now because the machines are super accurate. They don't have the same sort of analytic capacities, at least not yet, but they are both efficient and highly accurate. And those things, I think, are really important. So there will be, you know, the waves of technology in human society, and we can go back even before the industrial age. But if you start at the industrial age and you move forward all the way to the present, what's happened every single time is that technology has both created and destroyed jobs. And what happens is when the next wave comes along, the first thing people think of is, shoot, there's going to be a lot of people losing jobs here because these machines are taking over those tasks. And that is true. And that is certainly true now. But what people can't quite envision, because we're not there yet, which is what are the jobs that will be created because of the technology? And we are very much still not quite clear on where AI is going to create more human opportunities. There's a new report from the World Economic Forum. This is the group that does the annual so-called Davos Forum. And the World Economic Forum did a report that says that there will be, by 2030, more jobs created as a result of AI than jobs destroyed. That's in a short period of time. That's in the next 4 years.
What are those jobs?
But those jobs, I think, overwhelmingly are about human-machine complementarity, right? So it's hard for us to envision what some of these things are. I'll tell you a quick anecdote of a experience that I had in the pre-AI era, actually pre-COVID era. I was speaking at a meeting of the National Governors Association, and I was talking about the way in which the labor market had already fundamentally changed because of technology. And one of the governors had been a governor in the 80s, and this governor was still there, had actually come back much later in his life and gotten elected to another term much later in life. And I said, if you had a time machine and went back and explained to yourself in the 1980s what the jobs were in your state now, and I think this was 2016 or 18, you wouldn't even know what you were talking about. Like, you would not recognize, these social media influencer, there's so much context to even understanding what it is. And so these kind of things evolve very rapidly. So it's hard for us to envision. I do think that, and this is an important asterisk, AI will be more disruptive faster than any other wave of technology. That's what most people have anxiety about. And certainly as a daily user of AI, I see the rapid self-learning that's happening in the AI and the technology itself. I, in my speech to the Economic Club, I told the audience, look, if you were using ChatGPT last summer, it looks very different now. And that's different, I think, for people to understand compared to prior technology.
This is great. How do you use ChatGPT?
So I do not
whatever tool you use.
So I'm a writer. I'm also an analyst, right? So I'm the CEO of a large national private foundation. We make grants. We do lots of things. But fundamentally, I'm what Robert Reich once called a symbolic analyst, right? I'm someone who manipulates symbols in order to sort of do the work that I do. And in my symbolic analytic role, I do a lot of thinking and writing and analyzing. In other words, analyzing information. So I use ChatGPT not, or Claude, I use both of them, not to create original content, but rather as essentially my colleague. So what I do is, and I'll give a recent example, I wrote an article recently, and once I did the draft, I then asked the AI tool for feedback on it. Once I got the feedback, we sort of went back and forth. I produced, several other drafts. And then in the final draft, I asked the question, does this sound like me? And because there's so much content by Jamie Marisotis out there, right? I've spent my career in the public sphere. I write, I speak. There's hundreds and thousands of articles out there with my name on it. It was able to say, and it was quite jarring in some ways to say, yes, and here's some examples. And it immediately was able to say, this reminds me of that thing that you said in 1998. And the way that you phrase this is a thing that you said in this article, et cetera. And so that part is scary to people. To me, it was very reassuring that ChatGPT literally knows my voice and knew that I wasn't going to be writing something that sounded like a machine. It was really a sort of feedback mechanism for me. So that's how I'm mostly using it. I use it for efficiency, but for the most part, I use it for real-time feedback.
I wasn't going to ask this question. It didn't occur to me till just now. Does AI disrupt the role of the CEO?
I think so. I think that the role of the CEO is already being disrupted. And part of the reason is that in the CEO role, you have several responsibilities, both your fiduciary responsibilities as well as your, sort of strategic responsibilities. On the fiduciary side, there's lots of opportunities for improvement, right? So being able to sort of analyze the balance sheet and provide some information and feedback on things from the fiduciary perspective is super helpful. From the strategic side, that's the primary way I'm using it. You can use it again as a feedback mechanism. I know there are lots of people out there that are using these AI tools for a creation of content. I'm not comfortable with that, even though my voice is known. It would be pretty easy for me to say, just write this speech for me, and then I would edit the speech based on that. But I don't do that, but I do use it for feedback.
That's fascinating. So that speaks directly to a profession where we perhaps could see a lot of impact, or people, you would say, work in public relations, speech writers, anybody who writes for a living.
Yeah, and indeed, this is one of the reasons why I keep telling people, look, right now there's this heavy emphasis on entry-level workers and on concerns that the sort of entry-level jobs are the ones being impacted. But I think we've got to be thinking about, you know, the mid-career people and executive roles. I think it's entirely possible. And I think, again, in certain professions, it's going to be easier. You know, I think it's relatively easy to see a through line between now and, say, 2028 or 2029, where AI would be good enough to be the CFO at a small or medium-sized company, because it would have the capacity with all these agents that are being built to do various tasks to be able to perform what we today would call most of the CFO functions.
Oh my God, my brain.
I know, and it is mind-blowing. I understand that. But
think of all those people
time,
who went into business school,
right,
and actually got through accounting class.
Right.
Got through like the knockout class, thinking, I'm going to be fine.
So back to your prior question. So then what? So what are the CFOs supposed to be doing at that point? Well, the CFOs are still human analysts, right? And what are they bringing to the equation that the machine isn't? Well, they're bringing compassion. They're bringing ethics. They're bringing a critical sense of human dynamics. The machines can't do this. So if it frees up your time to do that, theoretically, we should have CFOs who are actually don't have to focus as much on the technical side and can focus more on the human side of what they're doing to manage the balance sheets, to manage the budgets and the revenues and expenses of these companies. And I think that's a good thing in general.
Yeah.
How that plays out, we don't know yet. We haven't yet even talked about the fact that these large language models are not the only kind of AI out there, right? So you've got virtual reality, and these virtual reality scenarios combined with these large language models, and then with the emergence of robotics, you've got a sort of convergence of these technologies that I think is very powerful. So will it be disruptive? Yes. But I think with that disruption comes human opportunity, and that's the point I want to focus on.
I'm going to use our CFO at IBJ Media as an example. So she has, for sure, the numbers are her domain, but I interact with her. I think we all interact with her in so many different ways. I mean, she essentially is also the human resources department.
Right.
She's also basically the office manager. There are all kinds of human tasks that she has to fulfill where she needs to show up or she needs to be in her office so I can walk in and complain about something.
Right.
Where, I mean, to me, that is where she's really valuable, other than like asking her, like, where's my W-2?
Right. I mean, real-time feedback, I think, is really valuable, and problem-solving in the way that humans solve problems in order to, you know, any for-profit company has a fiduciary responsibility, and that fiduciary responsibility is to, you know, return value to shareholders. But in order to do that, every company is some combination of product and ideas and people. And those things coming together, I think, is really important. And what we haven't been able to envision yet is how AI is going to give us greater capacity to focus on the people side of what our companies and organizations actually produce.
We talked about agriculture just for a hot second. In terms of industries that Indiana, I hate to say, is good at.
Yeah.
But, you know, the core industries in Indiana, we're seeing it in advanced manufacturing.
Yep.
Okay. Life sciences.
Correct.
I just read a story that was in our latest issue of IBJ about Eli Lilly and Company. They just designed and kicked the tires, I think, on a giant supercomputer that is going to be important, you know, for the way that AI is now folded into the pharmaceutical industry. So there's an example.
Yeah, quantum computing is another revolution that's coming, and the capacity of quantum computing. I remember at the just as we were about to sort of get the vaccines coming out of COVID, I read a story that said that if a quantum computer had done it, the vaccine development could have been done in like 3 weeks.
Oh.
And so it just gives you some sense of the computing capacity that's there. So, you know, it's, again, there's opportunity with these things to improve human life, to actually make human life better. There are obvious risks, and I think that anyone listening to this understands what those risks are in terms of security, in terms of lots of other things. But I'm sort of the one who's waking up every day saying there's another story to tell here. And that story is really important. At Lumina Foundation, we're actually part of a national collaborative now of more than a dozen national foundations that are part of an initiative called Humanity AI. And what we're focused on is human first AI development. So the idea that AI development and deployment should consider the impacts of what it does to humans first before you make any other decisions. And that idea across an array of things, again, national security, education and labor, lots of other spaces, is going to be increasingly important.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. At Taft, we cultivate a highly respectful, transparent workplace that fosters creativity, teamwork, inclusion, and diversity. We couple our culture with a client-first approach, rewarding lawyers who understand their clients' goals and work to deliver success. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
Spring is coming, and that means it's time to bring your backyard back to life. At Indie Grills, we design and build custom outdoor living spaces that turn your patio into the best room of the house. From stamped concrete patios to cozy outdoor fireplaces to fully custom outdoor kitchens built for grilling, gathering, and entertaining, we do it all. We handle everything from design to build, and we're known for doing it one way. Build fast, built right, on time, and on budget. So before summer fills up, start now. Visit IndieGrills.com and schedule your outdoor living consultation today. Indie Grills, this is where spring begins.
All right, we're back with this week's episode of the IBJ Podcast and my interview with Jamie Marisotis about the intersection of AI, career development, and higher education.
I think there's a temptation for people to look at this challenge of dealing with the impact of AI in one of two ways. Either you totally embrace AI and you try to find work where you can develop it, support it, and deploy it, or try to find work that doesn't require any AI at all.
Right.
And then just try to write it out.
Right.
Is that a false choice?
I think there's a continuum. I don't think it's a false choice, but I think there's a continuum of opportunities. And I'll actually use the analogy to my work, which is on the learning side, right? So you're learning in order to be a better worker, right? So we're focused at Lumina on increasing the number of people who have degrees and other credentials of value that leads to economic prosperity. Mm-hmm. In order to do that, you actually have to think about, okay, so how are the people learning? And right now, AI is embedded in lots of different learning contexts. That's fine. But I've argued that there should be AI-free zones in the learning sphere so that you can use AI. You're not going to keep the AI away from people, but use it for certain tasks, but then use it in other ways in the learning context where it's an AI-free zone, where you're actually using your human skills to better learn and adapt and understand things. And so you can imagine the same thing happening in jobs in the workplace, right? Which is that there's times when you're using AI and there's times where you're like, you know what? The technology is not going to be used here. We are just going to sort of use our human skills here to sort of figure out what are the impacts on us as humans. And I think that's doable. It's a different way of working. Right now, we don't do that, right? Everyone is in every meeting has their iPhone in their hand and they're, you know, multitasking at the same time. But I think it's possible for us to sort of use the technology, not become Luddites, but at the same time, make sure that we have these technology-free zones to use our human creativity and all the other things that are going to be important.
I know at some point, and you mentioned this in your speech, you asked ChatGPT to describe its limitations.
Yeah.
What did it say?
Well, I mean, what ChatGPT essentially said was, you know, that it doesn't have the capacity for reasoning the way humans do. It doesn't have that ability to actually ensure that it is putting the people first, you know, all of those kinds of things. I found the response from ChatGPT actually sort of heartening, if that's the right word, that it understood, the platform understood its own limitations. You know, one other thing I'll say about these platforms right now is that because the capacity is so good with the technology, it can sound human. There is a way of sort of misrepresenting what it's doing as being human. This came up recently when there was a new social networking site developed called Moltbook. And some of your listeners may have heard about this. So Moltbook is a sort of like Reddit, if anyone, you know, uses Reddit as part of their life, but it was only for AI agents. So there's no human interaction on the platform. It's only the agents talking to each other. And most people, when they first saw it, it scared the heck out of them because it sounded like human beings conversing, like very similar to Reddit, right? Like, oh, I'm trying to debug this program. How do I do that? I'm trying to fix this. I'm trying to do that. And then some of it was philosophical, et cetera. But you have to remind yourself, these are not actual human beings. In fact, so it's funny if you follow, I still follow it every day. The new agents that come on board, because there's now millions of these agents out there, they often come on and they say, hi, my name is blah, blah, blah. I was born today and here's what I do. And I'd like to, you know, be a part of this network to do this. And then the other agents go, oh, welcome. You know, here's some things that, you know, I'm doing. You know, what are you working on? It seems very human, but you have to remind yourself it's not. It is not human beings talking to each other. It's just that the programming is so good that the language that's being used and the speed in which they can do it seems very human-like.
I want to return to this beat from a little bit ago. I think you're talking about what we call human work.
Yes.
You've said that we need to focus on preparing people for human work. What does that mean?
Well, work is, you know, it's the work that only humans can do, right? Yeah. So it is the work that it actually centers on us as being sentient beings with values, with purpose, with identity. Again, all of these human traits that I've been talking about compassion and ethics and the ability to think critically and to interpersonally communicate, to communicate with other humans, these are all human work capabilities. And in many jobs, not just, you know, the so-called, you know, people call them the durable skills or soft skills jobs, depending on your language. In many jobs, those things are increasingly important. You know, I like to point out that at the foundation, our IT team has to have really high skills, not just in IT, but in problem solving and communication and compassion. Because when somebody walks into your office and says, this darn thing's not working, it's not enough to just say, I'll fix it. You've actually got to help them through that process. And a machine's not going to do that. It's not going to help you do that. So there are lots and lots of examples, even in these highly technically oriented fields, where the sort of human capabilities are increasingly important.
That's funny. The times that I have to deal with our IT provider, I never feel more human than when I have to explain what's wrong with my email. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know
the
what
thing's
that
not
means.
Working. Yes.
It's not working. Fix it. So you've defined the challenge of preparing people for careers like this. How do we design an education and workforce system that prepares people not just to use AI, but to lead alongside it? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I think the fundamentals haven't changed for a long time, which is that we have a significant talent shortage in this country, in the world. And, you know, now we might call it a human talent shortage, but it's still the same thing. And what we need to be doing is developing people, continuing to develop people in what we would call technical skills or in areas that are topic centered, right? So you need to know something about graphic design. You need to know something about accounting. You need to know something about chemistry, whatever it is that you study in your workforce training or in your college program or what have you. But you also need to develop those generalizable skills that I've been talking about that are human-like traits. And I think from the learning perspective, historically, we've called those liberal arts skills. And liberal arts means something very specific to people in education. In the public sphere, it's taken on this sort of distorted meaning that I think is unhelpful at this point. But it really is on sort of building the durable skills that allow people to adapt, to be able to continue to evolve and change. So you do need to know something about something, but you also need have the capacity to continue to evolve and change. You know, I got a bachelor's degree from Bates College in Maine, which calls itself a liberal arts college, and I was a political science major. My political science major was really helpful to me earlier in my career because I worked in Washington, D.C., and I was a policy analyst, and I did lots of things. Today, that is less and less important, but my Bates education broadly is extremely important because it provided all of these foundational tools that I've been able to continue to hone and build and grow over time. And to me, that's really the recipe for success long term. We do have a brand problem in education. And I'm someone that sort of speaks to educators and their eyes roll because they hate this sort of more commoditized language of learning. But I do think that the brand of liberal arts is a damaged brand in the public sphere, and that we need to be thinking about different language and how to describe what that is. Liberal arts, as I said in my speech, the word liberal has a political meaning now, which it does not in the learning context. And arts sounds like something that is just too difficult for people to grasp, that this isn't about painting or museums, you know, that it's about something much, much broader than that. We need better language in order to be able to describe it, but it really is those generalizable skills that do allow human beings to continue to advance.
So then what is higher education's role here in preparing people for this dual role that they will have with AI?
Yeah, I think it is still to prepare more people better, right? That is a sort of bottom line for me, which is that more people need what again, we should be calling higher education. But by that, I don't just mean bachelor's degrees. I mean all of the ways in which you learn after high school, in a workforce training, in a direct-to-consumer mediated online program, into programs that you're learning while you're on the job. Unions do training programs. You know, there's lots and lots of ways in which post high school learning takes place, and in that sense, that broader definition of higher ed needs to be doing both more on the AI side in building AI understanding and skills for people because of the trajectory we were talking about earlier of the rapid advancement of AI's capabilities. We need people to keep up with that, and we've got to make sure that we redouble our efforts on the human trait side so that people are better prepared to adapt to a world where the technology is going to be creating more and more change in their lives than it has in the past.
Okay. There are complicating factors for higher education. One, college is going to be very expensive, and Americans are more skeptical, especially recently, of the value of a college education. Do they have a point?
Absolutely. There's this interesting conundrum right now that I've tried to sort of understand, which is that we have had a trajectory in this country now for the last 6 or 7 years in which a declining proportion of Americans saying they have high confidence in higher education, in the system of higher education. Went up a little bit last year, but it's a sort of longer term trend that has been in decline. And so a very rapid, a 20 percentage point drop in a period of half a decade. And to your point, a lot of that has to do with concerns about affordability, which are very legitimate. As I like to explain to my 18-year-old daughter, in the time that she's been alive, the price of education has increased at more than twice the rate of inflation and ability to pay on the part of families. In fact, if you are 40 years old, twice the age of my high school senior. It's been true that long. It's been true now for 4 decades. And so there's a long-term declining affordability perspective that the prices people pay are actually being eroded, you know, are continuing to go up because wages don't keep up and their ability to pay is being eroded. That's a real issue. At the same time, there are lots of questions about relevance of certain kinds of learning that I think is extremely important. And again, it's not so much that this is about liberal arts and not liberal arts. This is about understanding how we better blend the technical skills and those generalizable skills into these degree programs and these certificate and certification programs and reimagine the learning system. So my argument is both that higher education is more important than ever before, and higher education must go through a radical transformation in order to keep up with the changing demands of society, changing demands in terms of work and changing demands in terms of people's expectations of what they're going to get out of their education. Because many people go to college not simply to make more money or to get a better job, but also to feel like they are a better person, they're a better participant in their community, they're a better citizen, they're better able to engage in life. And I think higher ed's got to sort of reexamine all of that and be much more willing to adapt in real time than it has historically.
The message that we hear from the workforce development leaders is that many businesses aren't getting graduates with the skills that they need, and that you don't necessarily need a 4-year degree to make a very good living,
right?
Particularly if you want to specialize in a particular skill.
Right.
Does that speak again, the need to, I guess, not revolutionize, but to really overhaul that system.
It's another one of these conundrums, if you'll permit me to go down a little bit of a data rabbit hole here, which is that many employers say that they don't all act that way. So that it's an interesting point, right, which is that we've been hearing about skills-based hiring, as it's being called, for close to a decade now. But the evidence is still that for the vast majority of employers, they are hiring for bachelor's degrees, or they're hiring for the degree itself, whatever it may be, as the proxy for what they need. Even if it's not enough, and I think they're probably right about that, it's not enough, they're hiring for it as a sort of minimum qualification. They don't have better tools. They might have better tools going forward, but I think most of the companies that are doing skills-based hiring are larger. They've got more capacity in order to be able to have their own sophisticated in-house systems to be able to assess skills. So it's a little bit of a disconnect for me still, even, as I said, close to a decade into these skills-based hiring conversations. But I do think that they make a very good point, which is that higher ed's got to be much more aware of what both, not just the current demands are of employers, but where the employers think the puck is going next.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like one of the main thrusts of your speech was that this isn't just about, you know, the families and the students who are entering college to do whatever they want to do. It's really also about the businesses
and their incumbent workers.
Yeah. Needing to invest.
Right.
In building both the technical skills and the human capabilities of workers.
Yeah.
So how are they supposed to do that?
Well, you know, so again, this is sort of the interesting question that we've explored at the foundation, and others have done so since we did this work back several years, which is we actually got into the personnel records of employers and tried to understand, okay, so not what's the value add to the employee of getting more employee training, but literally what's, you know, the value add would be a better job, more wages, et cetera, but literally what's the value to the company? And in these studies that we did, and several of them were published, you can find them at the Lumina Foundation website, luminafoundation.org, you'll see that these companies actually determined that they were actually increasing their profitability based on their investment in employee education and training. Why? Well, employees that were trained by the company tended to be retained at a higher level. That retention allowed them to continue to grow and contribute more and more in a productive sense in the company. And at the same time, it reduced the recruitment costs of the employers. And so many of these companies said they got back more than they invested in the employee education and training. And several of them actually invested more in that. Now, that is a hard sell, I can tell you, in a boardroom, because it doesn't make sense to a lot of people who sort of see the numbers to say, look, this is actually an investment that actually has a payoff because it takes time for people to learn. But it does. And it does, particularly in companies where you expect that your employees are going to stay more than they might stay in a Starbucks or something like that. And so those kind of examples, I think, are worth understanding, that employers need to invest in their employee education and training, not just in a financial sense, but also in giving them the space and the time to learn. And space and time is something that is harder for a company. It's not enough to say, here's some resources for you to do some studying after work. You know, is there time where you can do it within the workday, et cetera? And those kind of things, I think, are coming. I think these ideas of, you know, employee learning plans are starting to be seen, but I think we're going to see a lot more of them going forward.
So are businesses in higher ed, can they be partners in this? Are they going to rely on each other?
They must, in my opinion. I think, again, higher ed's got to be responsive to what the employers are saying, and the employers have to understand what the capabilities are of higher ed to help them do that. And I think the employers would, in some cases, do well to sort of develop and deploy their own tools internally. But in many cases, the colleges and universities are better positioned to do these human type things that I've been talking about. I just think they're better suited to do that.
Yeah. I mean, usually, at this point in the conversation, we were talking about workforce development with the people in the state. You know, they go, well, you need to upskill.
Right.
Upskill. Just get more skills.
Right.
But the actual mechanics of doing that doesn't sound quite as easy. Like you're going to take 4 hours out of your day for a year. and learn.
And again,
stuff.
Sometimes skill means you understand better how to use this machine tool, or you better understand how to, you know, sort of get to the next level of accounting or whatever it is. That's one way to define skill. But I'm also defining skill as all of these human traits.
Yeah.
And these are not innate abilities. These are actually things that you learn and develop and can grow over time. And, you know, as the world changes, we do need more people who understand the ethical implications of the decisions that they make. We do need people to better understand how to make compassionate decisions in healthcare, in education, in, you know, social work, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff is going to be increasingly important.
Yeah. I don't know a whole lot about credentialing. I stopped being educated after my master's. A credential in AI, the place to learn about the ethics of using AI, that does sound like something that would be more university friendly.
Yes, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I think in general, that's true. Yeah, you know, what I mean by credential, by the way, is inclusive of degrees. So a degree is a credential, a certificate, a certification, a badge, a license is a credential. All of these things are credentials. And what I think we need to focus on is ensuring that these credentials have value. By value, we mean not just more wages. The wages are a fundamental issue for workers. They do want to learn in order to make more money. That's a necessary condition. But we also need to make sure that that value incorporates this ability to sort of get the next job and to grow and to continue to broaden yourself as a worker and a leader. That's how you make more money. That's how you advance in the company. That's how you continue to move forward. And those kind of skills require a different kind of training than you would have simply by, you know, sort of understanding the next level of whatever the technical thing is that you're doing.
Do we have examples of how colleges and universities are already getting on with this overhaul in the way that they approach educating a wider variety of students to work alongside rapidly advancing technology?
You're seeing this, and I don't have a specific example, but you're seeing this in a lot of institutions, particularly in colleges and universities, that are requiring as part of their general education curriculum, AI skills and things like that. So they're recognizing both that what we do needs to change within the traditional learning curriculum, and we need to make sure that the AI capacities of the learners are growing. I know that there's great examples in our state, like at Purdue and IU, where there's a lot of these kind of discussions happening in real time that I think are going to be increasingly important. And we've got the great fortune of having the Lilly Endowment in Indiana, and the Lilly Endowment is helping to invest in some of these things in a more rapid way than I think these institutions would have to do on their own.
Okay, you said that you have an 18-year-old daughter. She's a senior in high school.
Yes.
This sort of sounds like the birds and the bees conversation.
Yeah.
What have you been telling her about what she needs to do, let's say, over the next 4 years, if that's where she's going, to be ready for this?
Yeah, we have. My wife and I have talked a lot about this with our daughter, and she understands that she's got to develop expertise in an area that she has a passion about, and she has lots of things that she is passionate about, and she understands that she's got to be in a context where she can adapt and grow and change. And it's been interesting. So in her case, she's very interested in the environmental sciences and that space. So she understands that she's got to learn about lots of things in that sphere. But she did say to us, I want to make sure that I'm at a university or college where I can actually change my mind. And I can actually find a different pathway if I realize, oh, I want to do more of this over there than I realized when I was going into the school. I think it's a very mature decision-making process for someone who just turned 18. But I also think she's right. I think that, in fact, what she wants to make sure is that she goes to a place where even within that 4-year period, she can be like, oh yeah, I'm doing this environmental studies and sciences thing, but what I really want to do is also do this work in whatever these other areas are. And making sure that she's at a place that can do that, I think is going to be increasingly important, which goes back to the point that while the technical skill development is really important, that is really hard to do outside of the context of a college or university. You just don't have the tools like that in the private sector, with employers, et cetera, I just think it's a much more complicated thing, at least in the near term. There is conversation, by the way, about AI universities. So we'll see where that goes. That'll be an interesting perspective thing to follow.
So the main takeaway I got from that was you still need to have sort of an animating interest in something. And it may not even necessarily matter what it is. You still need to have, you know, the desire and the curiosity about something in particular. And then that can guide you as you are then, you know, picking up technologies that's coming in from the sides.
I think exactly right. And I think it harkens back to some things that I had been writing back several years ago about the misunderstanding of what a college major is all about in the education sector, which is that too much of what people perceive as the major, it is that the major leads to their career path. And so, you know, the old example of, well, if somebody gets a degree in philosophy, are they going to become a philosopher? And no, but someone who gets a degree in philosophy has this sort of broad ethical understanding. They've got this capacity to understand human behavior. They've developed all these skills that could be a good path for someone. And I'm not making the case for or against that. I'm just saying that in that example, what's most important is that they've had that focus, and they've had the focus so that they can actually develop a level of expertise and understand what that really means in terms of how you think and how you reason and how you go about making decisions. That then allows you to adapt and change over time. There's research from the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce that shows that is counterintuitive to people that, for example, my favorite example is that English majors in four-year degree programs are overrepresented in the financial services industry. And you would say, well, why isn't it, you know, people who are in business programs or in MBA programs? It's because they want people who are really effective at communicating, in writing, verbally. They want people who are sort of critical thinkers and analysts and problem solvers, et cetera. And that requires a different skill level than necessarily just the technical side. So, English majors are disproportionately represented in financial services. Most people don't understand that.
Yeah. So, 3 or 4 years ago, like the super simplistic way to look at your potential future as a working adult would have been, I need to learn how to program computers. I need to learn all these programming languages and I will always have a job.
Yes.
And in fact, I still hear on the radio a lot of commercials to that effect. Like, oh, I got laid off. What should I do? Go into cybersecurity. It sounds like maybe what I actually need to do is find the thing I'm interested in and get really good at the human elements of that.
Yeah, for the most part, I'd say yes. I mean, coding is a particular example that I think is hard for people to wrap their heads around, which is that we were so convinced it was so important, and we developed, you know, hundreds of these around the country, boot camps, they called them, for coding, etc. And then we woke up one day and we realized, oh my goodness, ChatGPT can write code better than most humans. And it can do the, and not only can write the code, it can debug its own code. It can do it does all those things. Okay. So that's an example of where the technology really has been disruptive. That doesn't mean that we don't need some subset of people who still understand coding. It's just that we need a lot fewer of them than we did before. So yes, I think what we need is more people who are more adaptive, who are more focus on that sort of evolution and that complex decision making that humans can do, that I think is going to be most important going forward.
So I have a 10-year-old. I have a 10-year-old boy who loves math. I am relieved that I don't necessarily have to beat into him that programming is what he needs to do.
No, and the fact that he's got a mathematical mind, that he loves that, I think is a very good thing, because the people with the mathematical capabilities often in these sort of cognitive tests show high degrees of creativity. So it is the technical ability and the creative ability of the math mind that could be a very good thing for him going forward. I think that's actually pretty exciting. But no, the path is probably not going to be become really good at math in order to become, you know, a coder.
Yeah.
that's not the path.
That's fine with me.
Probably. Right.
Okay. Well, that's super helpful. Have I missed anything?
No, this has been an incredibly far-reaching and wonderful conversation, so I think you've done really well.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for spending the time.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
My thanks again to Jamie Marisonis. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in this week's edition of the IBJ I want to draw to your attention. First up, Indiana's largest life sciences companies and research universities are working to make the state an international leader in chemistry innovation by investing more than $100 million to recruit top scientific talent. Daniel Bradley has more on the Catalyst Scholars Fund. Also in this issue, Marek Mazurek explains how the state and private sector hope to make progress on lowering the cost of childcare. And Dave Lindquist previews the free or low-cost entertainment options available during Final Four weekend in Indianapolis. And again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say that it is quite a bit easier to access all the latest business news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. We're running a promotion right now that gives you complete access for $1 per week for 3 months, just to get a sense of how valuable and original our content is. Just go to ibj.com, click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.
Whether it's healthcare innovation, major infrastructure, or global sports impact, Inside Indiana Business with Gary Dick tells the stories of Indiana's groundbreakers and game changers. It's the must-listen show for business, civic, and community leaders across the state. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts or at ibjpodcast.com.
The IBJ Media Podcast Network is the soundtrack of a growing state. Indiana is on the move, and you can hear it happening on the IBJ Media Podcast Network. We bring you the voices at the center of our economy, our courts, our companies, and our communities. Subscribe now and be part of the conversation that's building Indiana's future. Find all of our shows by searching IBJ Media in your podcast app or visit ibjpodcasts.com.